big question is whether you are going to be able to say a hearty yes to your adventure. Joseph Campbell.
And I was able to set pace and kind of keep them going. But by 3 a.m. I was exhausted and resorted to, belting out country ballads in order to stay awake through the Buttonwood Canal. Now, you Californians may not know this, but at night when you shine your light into brush and there's animal eyes that look back, predator eyes are red. And like frog eyes or non-predator eyes are like white or silver. And so going down the Buttonwood Canal, so sleepy I'm about to fall out of my boat, you turn your head left or right and all you see is a sea of red eyes. All crocodile eyes.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the trail, Dirtbags and Hiker Trash. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. Now, you know, I say that every week. And yet, you know, the reviews are not coming in. So I'm not sure whether to take that as nobody's enjoying the podcast or that you're just very busy in your lives and you just can't find the time to take 1 or 2 minutes and help us out and leave that review. So I'm just going to implore you right now, again, please, if you enjoy the podcast, let us know, fill out a review. I know that people are tuning in and they're listening. I can't imagine that everybody that's listening is a brand new customer who listens to it for the first time and says, oh no, this is not for me. I have to imagine we have some repeat customers out there. So if you are a repeat customer, really just help us out a little bit. All right, let's get to this week's guest who joined us in season 3 to talk about his incomplete Everglades challenge attempt. Welcome back to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, Brian Sheridan. How's it going, Brian?
Hey, Doc. It's great.
Hey, have you left us a review on Apple Podcasts?
Well, I was going to say, I am not an Apple Podcast user. I'm a Spotify user, but I've left you a review on Spotify.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you so much. Was it a 5-star or 1-star?
You know, 4.8. We can't go all the way.
4.8. Okay. That's about my average. So that's okay. It falls in line. Thank you so much. Hey, Brian, I know that last time I think we took the call on you BS because of your initials, Brian Sheridan. Have you picked up a trail name along your latest endeavors out there?
I have. It's also BS. So it's Buffalo Soldier is my official like tribe name, which is kind of like a trail name for paddle sports. And I picked that up in 2001. Paddling the Wilderness Waterway through the Everglades National Park. And I was with a few older gentlemen. One of them needed help pulling his boat up onto a dock. And I just reached over and picked it up one-handed and flipped it up onto the dock for him. And he said that I was like a water buffalo hauling stuff for him. And I'm also into reggae, so the Buffalo Soldier kind of came and stuck.
Nice. You're into reggae. Tell me a little about that.
I just like reggae music, man. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Caribbean when I was going to sea, and just enjoyed the you know, beach vibes and, you know, soul reggae.
Do you have reggae going on when you're out on your challenges there?
I don't really listen to music too much when I'm out paddling, a little bit. And if I do, it's because it's super late at night and I'm trying to not fall asleep in my boat. And then I usually do like honky tonk sing-alongs, you know, like good old, you know, old school country.
Yeah. I would think that if you're trying not to fall asleep, it's not just listening to music. There has to be an active part to it.
Right.
Singing along. That's probably a very, very good strategy.
Yeah, exactly. Amarillo by Morning's a favorite.
Mm-hmm. If only Jeff Legend Garmeyer had followed that principle while he was setting his FKT on the JMT. You know, he did 220 miles on foot in 72 hours and 47 minutes. But at some point, he found himself asleep. He doesn't remember going to sleep, but he found himself asleep kind of on the side of a stream. He actually had fallen asleep while he was while he was running.
Yeah, I listened to that episode. It was amazing. He's an inspiration, that guy.
He is a madman, but he is so much fun to talk to.
He is. He is very entertaining. I'm looking forward to his movie that's coming out.
Same. Yeah. All right. Hey, you've been on the podcast before. You're obviously listening to the podcast. You know that we have a segment towards the end of the episode called the Pro Tip Insight of the Week, where I will turn to you and ask you to share some wisdom with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So I know you won't be surprised by that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The Must Bring Gear Review.
Hey, BS, another feature we've been doing this season is the Must Bring Gear Review, sponsored by the ultralight backpacking gear company Six Moon Designs. Here's how it works. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day adventure, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you have a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So, Brian, what is your must-bring piece of gear? And you notice that I tailored it to multi-day adventure. What do you need out there
on
the Everglades Challenge? What do you insist on being packed?
A must-have for me is earplugs. There's, mosquitoes, no-see-ums, you know, buzzing, humming bugs. And they get in your ears and you can't sleep and it's no good. And so if you're going to do a multi-day, you know, South Florida adventure, I highly recommend earplugs.
Okay. And does that kind of fall under the category of ignorance is bliss? I mean, do you use those while you're adventuring or while you're sleeping? Or both?
While you're sleeping, because I sleep inside a tent, you know, with a mosquito mesh. You're not getting bit.
Okay.
But you can stay still, you know, they're so thick, they can literally make a mat around the outside of your tent, like underneath your rain fly.
Yuck.
Yeah. With an incentive, an unbelievable hum.
Now we're going to be talking about Florida today, but I'm in Southern California and there has been a recent influx within the last 9 months of, I believe it's something from Asia that's come over on the boats, the shipping containers, these mosquitoes that we've never had before, these little, you can't even, it seems like I never see them out there, but I always come in after barbecuing or after sitting out on the patio with just tons of bites around my ankle and my legs. And I, you know, I'm not the only one. It's in the news out here that we're being invaded.
Well, get the spray out. It works.
I hope your pro tip at the end has something to do with mosquitoes. I'm really looking forward to that.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
It's the hiking pole.
All right. So you've done the hiking pole before, and I think I tailored it to kind of your adventures at the time. And what I've done since then, if I have a repeat customer on, I have thrown out the old questions. I brought in some new questions. I've decided, you know, let's talk about some of the big issues facing our society today. Now you haven't seen these before, so you have no idea what I'm going to ask you.
No.
I'm going to ask you 7 questions. We could probably spend an entire podcast episode, maybe even an entire podcast season on some of these, but I'm going to get your initial reaction, what side of the fence you fall on, to give you a rating on the insanity scale from 1 to 100. Actually, I'm going to put it as the sanity scale, because 1 is most insane. 100 is completely sane.
Okay.
All right. How do you think your friends and family would rate you at this point?
Well, I think I'm less crazy than a thru hiker who does a ultra long trail, but I'm definitely, you know, section hiker crazy. Let's put it that way.
Section hiker crazy. I like that. So is a long trail thru hiker, that person would be about, you know,
crazier.
45, 40.
Yeah, I don't
closer,
know. Yeah.
Closer to zero, right?
Yeah, I don't want to put labels on it, but definitely they're closer to crazy than I am.
And section hiker would be a little bit saner, a little bit more sane.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely thinking about, you know, showing up to work next Tuesday.
Nice.
The thru hikers don't even have jobs, so
That's right. That's right. They're walking for 5-6 months at a time. Or if you're like Jason Cook, you're out there for a couple of years. I mean, he's out there right now on a 16,000 mile trek.
Yeah. He's a two.
He's a two. I'm going to let him know. He's a two. Very good. All right. So you have no idea what questions I'm going to ask. Or you know what? You're a regular listener. You might have heard some of these before.
Maybe.
Okay. So let's get your take on these. Question number one. Do you sleep with your socks on?
Hard no.
Hard no. Hard, firm no. Very definitive.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I weigh 300 pounds and I get sweaty real easy.
Okay. No.
I mean, sweat. I'm like a AC at 70 degrees with just a sheet and underwear if I have to.
Okay. We're That's venturing it. Into the TMI category, but I like yeah. it. I like
you
it.
You asked.
I did. I was actually asking about your socks, but okay.
Yeah. Hard no socks.
Hard no. All right. Question number two. This one, an entire season, we can spend on this one. Does pineapple belong on pizza?
Also hard no.
Really?
Yeah, no.
What does belong on pizza?
Meat and cheese with minor vegetables.
What are the minor vegetables?
Oh, you know, peppers, garlic, maybe onions, maybe some mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
About
what
it
would, what would qualify for the major vegetables
is you know like a supreme is, like a is, yeah a supreme pizza with you know a foot and a half of arugula on top of it.
Okay, so when you say minor vegetables, do you just mean the amount or there's a category
yeah, quantity of vegetables? Quantity no I don't mean like significant okay. or insignificant vegetables. I just mean
all right I thought know, we were 10, gonna do I thought we were gonna do a veg. deep dive no. into the vegetable kingdom. What are the minor vegetables and the major vegetables?
No fruit on pizza, period.
No fruit on pizza. All right. Question number three. Do you roll your toilet paper over or under?
I'm a dog person, so I'm a over. So I have friends who are cat people and they do the under to avoid the catastrophe toilet paper incidents.
Catastrophe toilet paper instance. Is that a thing?
I believe so. I mean, have you ever owned a cat?
I have not. Well, when I was a kid, when I was little, but not as an adult, no.
If you get an angry cat, man, you'll come home and your like whole bathroom will be destroyed because they're upset at you or something. That's a catastrophe.
You know, I have to say I was a little taken aback. I have never had the answer to that question be, well, I'm a dog person.
That's right.
As the lead in to the explanation of whether.
But I mean, the only reason for the under roll is if you have a cat who likes to do the, you know, pitter patter on the toilet paper. It right. just goes around and around with the under roll. But that the rest of the world should use the over roll.
Yeah. So the cat can't gain traction on the under roll.
Well, no, it just spins around. Just they're
it kind, spins they're, and it yeah, does yeah. not doesn't come off.
Right.
Got it. All right. Well, that makes the next question kind of obvious. Next question is cats or dogs?
Yeah, dogs.
Dogs. Big dogs, little dogs?
This is a debate in the house. So I have two daughters who want a purse dog. But I have a hard, fast rule of if it's not a large enough dog to pick up a full-size tennis ball, we cannot have it.
That is interesting.
Yep.
You know, we have a rule at our house that if the dog has poop that's bigger than your poop, then you know that's not a dog we can have. This is like opposite ends of the spectrum. These are good rules.
Yeah. I mean, I have a Boston Terrier, so I mean, he's like 30 pounds. He's not a big dog, but he can catch a frisbee and pick up a full size tennis ball.
A full size tennis ball, as opposed to the undersized tennis ball.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they make like tennis balls the size of a marble. Which, you know, Fifi, the purse dog can pick up and then that doesn't count.
The purse dog. Now, yeah. A purse dog, I think the definition of a purse dog obviously is a dog that you can carry along in a satchel, a device that goes over your shoulder.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. Question number four. No, Question five. There are these little animated pictures, little short videos, and it's the name for them is spelled GIF. How do you pronounce that?
I pronounce it GIF.
GIF with a hard G.
Yeah. Like gift with no T.
Like gift with no T.
Kinda. I don't know. GIF, whatever. I don't you're the English major, man. I'm a dyslexic engineer who chose my degree because it only had three English classes.
Okay. I like just waiting sometimes and just seeing how long the awkward silence goes on.
great podcast content there.
Yeah, right. People are on the edge of their seats. What is going to happen next?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, speaking of English, question number six, do you use the Oxford comma?
No, I do not. And I don't have a reason behind it, mostly because I think it's easier to, not guess than guess wrong.
Okay. All right. I mean, is punctuation overrated?
You know, again, that's like asking a colorblind person if rainbows are overrated. You know, it's I can barely write a paragraph without the use of a spell check and grammar check. So,
punctuation has not been a big part of your life.
No, not at all. Not at all. Like I said, I chose my major because there was three English classes, one of which was technical writing. So yeah, grammar's not my thing.
That's great. I know that some people choose their majors because they don't want to have anything to do with math or with science. You went the non-English route.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, you speak it fluently, but right. Hey, when it comes to the mechanics, less is more.
Exactly.
Got it. All right. And then my favorite question, is a hot dog a sandwich?
You know, technical definition, it is meat on a bun. I'd say yes. A hamburger is a sandwich, right?
Yeah, I would call a hamburger sandwich. Yeah, it's under the sandwich section of most restaurant menus.
Right. I would say yes, sandwich.
Okay. All right. Hey, let me do some quick calculation here. Let me put it through the algorithm. We're going to carry the two.
Now you're talking my language.
Nice. I can divide by root three. What is root three exactly? You have an approximate numerical value for that?
The square root of three?
Yes.
Is an imaginary number. It has two answers.
It does. It has a negative root and a positive root, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Look at me, former English teacher, spouting off some math principles.
Yeah, it's only like one of a few math questions that have multiple answers.
Okay. And we're also going to take that and multiply it by pi. Can you give me pi to five digits?
Oh, I don't know, but I can do 3.147 for sure.
Okay.
I don't know the rest. I got, four.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll give you a bonus point for that one. And then we're going to go ahead and adjust that for the level of humidity at Sanibel Island on the Everglades Challenge. And I come out with a very solid, surprising 65 for you.
Okay. Fairly sane.
Yeah. You are definitely above the midpoint.
Okay.
How do you feel about that?
Better than average, I'm good.
Better than average. All right. Hey, let's move on to our next section here. Let's remind folks, you've been on the podcast before. Just refresh our memories in terms of your background, where you grew up, what kinds of sports and hobbies you were involved in as a kid, how you got involved with outdoor adventure. And we'll just leave it right there for right now. Start with that.
Yep. Grew up in Texas, was in Boy Scouts and basically started backpacking, hiking, canoeing in Boy Scouts. And then I went to a maritime academy on the coast of Texas called the Texas Maritime Academy. It's part of Texas A&M. And there I did, I sailed a lot. I was on the offshore sailing team. Got big into boat racing there. And then later was a chief engineer on private yachts, moved to Florida. And then that sort of brings us to my 2020 Everglades attempt. So the Everglades Challenge is a 300-mile race from Tampa to Key Largo through Everglades National Park and 10,000 Islands National Park, and then ends in the Keys. It's a mix of offshore and inland routes. So I knew about the race in college, like as a sailboat race. And in 2020, the race happened on my 40th birthday. So I decided to attempt the race. And if you want to hear all the details, you can listen to my other episode. Long story short, I didn't make it. And then we did a podcast about, you know, sort of lessons learned and a couple near-death experiences on the race. And yeah, and then so in 2021, I kind of made a promise to the wife and the family I would not attempt the race again, just because the amount of time and energy needed to train for the race, and then re-attempted the race in 2022 this March.
Oh, wow. Now I have to ask you, I mean, are you in Florida right now?
Yeah, I live in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay, you're in Fort Lauderdale. So you are probably familiar with the Tom Brady and Gisele Bündchen situation that's currently going on.
Yeah, I mean, who really cares?
Yeah, well, the guy retired from football, right? And then he unretired. And then I think he was given an ultimatum by Gisele.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Obviously, he chose football. He chose football. He's currently playing football. So I only bring that up to ask you. I mean, you had announced your retirement from the Everglades Challenge, and then you decide to do it again. Are we in similar territory for you?
No. I mean, I was in the car ride home from my failed 2020 attempt. I was already talking about training and trying it again.
Mm-hmm.
But the meet in the middle with me and the wife was that I would not try it that next year immediately. I would wait a year and then do it in 2022.
Got it. All right. Now, what has happened since the last time we talked? Don't necessarily get into Florida, because
right,
we talk about Hurricane Ian and the after effects and aftermath of all that and how that impacted you or particularly the course of the Everglades Challenge. But what else has happened with you since the last time we talked?
So just because I don't do the Everglades Challenge doesn't mean I don't want to, you know, get out there and have some, you know, backcountry fun. So a buddy of mine and I decided to do a section hike of the Appalachian Trail in Vermont. So we went from Bromley to Killington, which is sort of two ski slope towns in Vermont. And I had a great time, and I had a real good experience with some pretty amazing trail magic. So on the first day going up, I think the second to last hill for the day, nothing California size, you know, it was like a, I don't know, 4,000 foot, hill. I lost my cell phone going up, and then we get to the top and I go to pull my phone out to take a picture of the view. I got no phone, which is a problem, 'cause that was also my, you know, out my trail map as well. And, so I have a little freak out, run back down the trail, look for my phone. I don't find it. You know, continue on with the day, make it down to camp, you know, hanging my head low, kicking myself. We're eating dinner, and this like 19-year-old kid comes in like wide-eyed, crazy. And this is dark, you know, it's like 8:30, 9 o'clock. This guy rolls in, doesn't take his pack off, just sits at the we were at a shelter, so there was a picnic table, sits at the picnic table, and just starts cooking his, you know, quickly made, you know, rehydrated dinner. Start talking to him. He's like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to Bromley tonight, you know, going for it." And, you know, I kind of felt bad for the kid. I was like, "All right, man, you know, it's supposed to be cold tonight, you know, into the 30s, and you're going on top of the hill, so it'll probably be even colder up there. You know, do you have a jacket?" You know, I was just a little fatherly advice. And then he lets loose that he doesn't have any money. He's meeting his mom in Bromley, and that he's going to camp on the side of the road, meet her tomorrow morning. I was like, "All right, man, like, look, here's $20 and a you know, oh, and he's out of snacks too. The food, the dinner that he's eating was the only food that he had, the last rehydrated meal. So, I mean, I brought extra food and I had, you know, $100 cash on me. So I gave him a 20 and like, you know, a Snickers and was like, by the way, if you see a black iPhone, it's mine. Could you please, you know, drop it off at the, cause there's a, it's called the Bromley Inn where we stayed. There's a little hotel right there. And that's where we left our car. Could you please drop my cell phone there? And he's like, oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I'll find your phone. No, 100%. So anyways, we hike on and this is day one. So we're out for 4 days. When we get back to the Bromley Inn, there's my cell phone, like perfectly clean, detailed, like didn't look like it was in a mud pile on a trail. This kid apparently found my phone, took it out, detailed it, cleaned it, brought it to the hotel. They charged it. My wife's calling me, looking for me. They answer the phone, talk to the wife. They're like, yeah, this kid dropped off your phone. Says she talked to your husband. He's fine. It was amazing. Trail magic at its
purest.
That
story took a turn there. I didn't know which way it was going to go. When you said trail magic, I thought, okay, somebody did some trail magic for you. And then the first part of the story is you doing trail magic for this kid.
Right.
But it turns out the end result of this is some rarely seen, or maybe it's not rarely seen, rarely heard of, two-way trail magic.
Right. It was good. Fantastic. I didn't get his name, but whoever he is, I wish him well. And he's a good kid. He apparently had started the AT like a year ago and then was trying to hustle through and finish the last section of his, you know, section through hike of the AT southbound in Vermont.
Right. Now, BS, have you done some hiking before like that before?
Sure. Yeah. I was a counselor at a backpacking summer camp in Colorado. We did. So every summer in high school, I would take a group of fifth grade girls up Pikes Peak in Colorado, which is like a 14,000 foot mountain.
Wow. And the lesson there then is that if fifth grade girls can do that, I mean,
right.
Sky's the limit.
That's right.
Okay.
Very true.
Had you done any hiking since then?
A little bit. I did some hiking in Big Bend National, like right after college. Mm-hmm. I did like a 60-mile loop there. But yeah, I mean, nothing crazy. And, right. You know, many years between hiking. I was amazed at how the gear had changed, from 2000 gear to 2020 gear. Big change.
How did you round up your gear for this particular trip? I mean, did you have to buy all new stuff or did you borrow?
Flatly, that's why I started listening to your podcast, was to educate myself on the new style backpacking gear. You know, when I last hiked, it was leather boots and wool socks and, a pack that weighs 10 pounds empty. And, trekking poles were for sissies. And, everybody used white gas, MSR stoves. So right.
And
that's
was the podcast helpful?
Absolutely.
Oh, 100%. Thank goodness. All right.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. So now I'm a ultra trail runner, spandex pants and shorts with, a Dyneema ultralight pack.
Nice. You are officially hiker trash.
Sort of, yeah.
You know the definition of hiker trash?
No.
Ivy Tat, in his episode, he defined hiker trash. Not everybody can be hiker trash. You can only be hiker trash if you have spent the night in a restroom.
Port-a-john or a restroom?
It could be a port-a-john. It could be a brick and mortar.
Okay.
Bathroom. So
yeah, I don't know if I qualify.
Yeah, I may have spent one or two nights in a bathroom in my house, but
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know if that qualifies though.
Yeah, I don't think it's the same.
Okay.
No.
All right, and then remind us again, what do you do to pay the bills?
So I'm
all this fun.
Yeah, I'm a marine engineer. I used to go to sea for a living on ships and private yachts, and now I am a project engineer at a yacht repair company called Engineered Yacht Solutions. So we repair metal hull vessels primarily.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because my sister, I don't know if I've talked about her on the podcast before. I have a couple sisters. The one I'm talking about right now, she actually referred a guest to me, Dina Zabaldo. If you listen to that episode, she is the trekking guide in Nepal. She was the guide of the year for some prestigious organization. There's only one of them per year, and she was it. But anyway, my sister, that particular sister, she and her husband live in a boatyard in Mexico, and they have been working on their boat, a metal hull boat, for it seems like the last couple of years. I always ask them, is the boat in the water yet? Not yet. We still have to replace this. We're doing this. We've got to adjust this. We've got to paint this.
Is that Ensenada?
No, it's not an Ensenada. It's a small town, and it's a boatyard that allows the people who live in the boatyard to actually work on their boats. They don't have to hire,
contractors. People, yeah.
Contractors. They can actually do the work themselves, and the rent is very cheap. It's like $300 a month. So they're living down in Mexico in a boatyard.
Oh,
wow. A month fixing this boat. And I always tease her because, boats usually touch water at some point. And this one seems like it does not touch water in a long time.
She sounds like, are you familiar with a guy named Bernard Messatier?
I am not.
French. Anyways, he wrote a bunch of books called The Long Way Down and The Long Way Around. But he's like a famous, dirty hippie sailor.
Okay.
Circumnavigated multiple times in a steel hull sailboat with no refrigeration and, eating canned sardines and cold beans. He's like the sailing equivalent of a cold soak through hiker.
Oh,
yeah. Hardcore.
That's low on the sanity scale.
Yeah. He's very low.
I don't know where we're going with that. You talked about your
anyways.
Your,
yeah. So
it reminded me of my sister living in a boatyard in Mexico, which is great. But also, I'm going to skip ahead right now. We're going to talk a little bit later about the adventure media recommendation. I'm going to recommend to you right now, if you have not seen it yet, check out Deep Water.
Okay. About the Deepwater Horizon.
No, there's three or four movies out there called Deep Water. This Deep Water is a documentary about an around the world sailboat race. And I think you can find it on YouTube. It's about an around the world sailboat race that starts from London, or maybe not London, but England. And it goes all the way around the world. The winner gets, so much money. And this is back in the 60s. And this guy, he was down on his luck. He was struggling with his finances. He had all kinds of creditors. And so he raised sponsorships. He thought, this is going to be a great way to kind of get myself out of debt. So he had very little knowledge of sailing, but he found himself, he passed himself off as an expert sailor, raised all kinds of sponsorships to get into this race. And he actually got a boat together, got out there, and he found himself in a world of trouble. This is a fascinating story about this guy who knows next to nothing out there, but just enough to be dangerous. And the situation he finds himself in is just amazing. So Deep Water, it's on YouTube. Check it out. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Yeah. I think that's the same race that Bernard Messatier did. It was called the Volvo Ocean Race.
Anyways. Could be. Yep, could be. Now, you said you used to go to sea for a living. What would you do out at sea? How would you earn your living?
I was the chief engineer of the vessel. So initially out of school, I sailed on container ships in the Indian Ocean and then also worked in the Gulf of Mexico on drill ships and then took a vacation to St. Martin, which is like a big yachting hub. And met some people who were in yachting, and they were basically offering the same salary, but much better life. And so I went home and packed up all my stuff, sold my car, and got a job on a yacht.
Now, what is life like on a container ship? I've often, you know, when we do stuff out and around by the ocean, we see the container ships out there. And I just wonder what it is like to make a voyage on a container ship. What is life like on a container ship?
Well, now it's a little different. Now they all have satellite internet and, you know, you're much more connected to the, you know, the shore via the internet. But when I was doing it, there was no internet. You know, maybe you could get like a text email once a week. You know, and so, I mean, it was a bunch of like VHS videos and lots of reading and, you know, very, very isolated. So, and also because I was on US flag ships, which are primarily crewed by, you know, 50% Americans and then 50% Filipino non-licensed crew. So maybe you're on a ship with 30 people, but, you know, 18 of them speak very limited English. So, I mean, you're not a lot, you know, you're not a lot of, you know, I spent months on a ship in the Indian Ocean and was never in a room with more than 10 people for 6 months.
And you didn't go stir crazy?
I mean, I went a little crazy, you know, because then I got dropped off at the Singapore airport, you know, and there's just this, you know, mass of humanity pressing against you. And I had to take a minute, you know, sit down and calm down for a minute. I had a little panic attack.
Wow, what a change. What a change being out for months at sea with, you know, very few humans around you to being just kind of like packed into a sardine can.
Right, right, exactly. At least they were only like chest high, so.
All right. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear about this year's attempt on the Everglades Challenge. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back.
From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. With the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it, Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young.
All right, welcome back. We're talking to BS, Brian Sheridan, and we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of your latest attempt at the Everglades Challenge. Now, remind us again, what got in the way of finishing this the last time you attempted it?
The short answer is fitness. I just wasn't physically fit enough to paddle as long and as fast as I needed to make the time cutoffs. Secondarily, one of the guys I helped set his sailboat up on the start line, I learned on day three that he had been lost at sea and, eventually, you know, learned that he had died at sea, never recovered his body. They found his boat, but not him.
Oh, wow. Did we cover this last time? I don't remember that.
Yes. Yeah, we did. Oh. So I made it to, Marco Island, which is, you know, a little over halfway. I was behind on time. I was going to have to paddle all night to make the next time cutoff at the next checkpoint. You know, I had a sore shoulder. And from Marco Island to the next cutoff point, there's nothing. So it's either I stop at Marco Island or I paddle the next 30 miles to the next checkpoint, because there's, you know, it's through 10,000 Islands National Park at night. You know, so I just decided to throw the towel in. You know, I got stuff to do on Monday and people counting on me to do it. And this race is not worth dying over. Also, I knew the weather was getting bad, so I didn't want to potentially put myself in a situation I need to call for help. You know,
well, that's very responsible of you.
You know, rule number one, don't be a next victim.
Nice. I like your rule book. All right. So what did you do having this past experience and this background knowledge about the race, this 300-mile race through Everglades National Park and 10,000 Islands National Park? How did you prepare differently?
So in 2022, or the lead up to 2022, I previously was focused more on like boat handling and like experience in the boat, and was trying to, my goal was really to put miles, you know, just do miles in the boat. And in the lead up to 2022, my focus was really more physical fitness. So I spent a lot more time in the gym, a lot more time on the rowing machine, you know, studied paddling efficiency, and learned a lot from a lot of my fellow competitors, you know, about this one particular guy named Scott Bass, who's known as Conquistador. He actually just finished the Yukon 1000 in a stand-up paddleboard. His big thing is that you can train a lifetime to go half a knot faster, but you can, you know, spend a weekend and get 30 minutes faster at setting up camp, taking down camp, cooking dinner, organizing your stuff. So I also focused a lot on speed of setup and takedown, you know, because if you're paddling, let's say 20 miles in a day, and the guy next to you is half a knot faster because he's a, you know, much better athlete, that's, you know, only an hour or sorry, 2 hours difference over a day. But if he camps 30 minutes slower than you, set up 30 minutes slower, take down 30 minutes slower, he's just eating half of his lead in set up and takedown. So a lot of what I focused on was speed, but not on necessarily on the water, you know, speed on the camping side.
So BS, that leads me to ask, you know, are you in competition against yourself, just trying to complete this attempt, or are you looking to chase down those folks in front of you and put them in the rearview mirror?
Well, both. You know, I mean, the race is really against yourself and the elements. But you know, you still have classes, and you know, when I started the race, I think there was 12 people in my class, so I had 12 other people to beat. You know, it's, you've heard the, you know, two boats on the water heading to the same place is a boat race.
That's so, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a race, you know, I'm not out there for last, you know?
That's right. I mean, there's competitiveness in each of us. I always hate when I'm jogging, if I see somebody in front of me, if there's another jogger out there, cause then I just feel compelled that, you know, I need to catch that person and
got to chase that rabbit.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly it. So you mentioned 12 people in your class. What class were you in?
So I was in what's called class one, which is recreational canoes and kayaks. And I was class one with sail. So I had a 1 square meter sail on the bow of my vessel.
Okay. How long was your vessel?
So I had an 18 foot, 6 inch long Kevlar canoe made by Clipper Canoes. It's called a C1. And it's called a decked canoe. It looks very much like a kayak, but the difference is it does not have bulkheads. So it's a kayak has, you know, compartmentalized spaces inside it that you can access with hatches. My boat's one big open space, you know, so if you pour a cup of water into the bow and lean the boat back, it'll roll all the way back to the rudder.
Got it. And it's made out of Kevlar, so you can withstand any attack from modern day pirates.
That and oysters. Use Kevlar instead of fiberglass or carbon fiber because it's tear resistant.
Okay. Now let's go to day one. You do you line up at the start line? Is there a start line in the water? You start on shore. How does that work?
So the race, you have to start about 30 feet above the high tide line. So all the boats start on dry sand. And then at 7 a.m., you know, the start gun, it's not really a start gun, they just say go. But you have to be able to get your own boat off the beach by yourself. Or, you know, if you're in a team of two people in the boat, you can't have any outside help at any point in the race. So other race competitors can help you beyond the start line, but no outside help at all from anyone in the race. So you're, you know, your wife can't meet you, you know, at an overpass with a package full of food. And you know, it's a big part of the race is no outside help. And if you want McDonald's, you just got to walk to McDonald's and get your own McDonald's. That's not a problem, but I don't suggest it.
You can get McDonald's on your own, but there's no throwing a bag of McDonald's from the overpass as you pass beneath.
Exactly. Got it.
And you mentioned earlier from your past trip that you just felt you weren't able to meet those time windows. What are the time windows? What are the checkpoints and what are the hours that you need to be there by?
So checkpoint one is about 50 miles from the start, and you have basically 26 hours or 28 hours to get there. So you start at 7 a.m. on Saturday, and you have to be past checkpoint one by, I think, 10 a.m. on Sunday. And then the next checkpoint is Chokoloskee, which is like 120 miles away, I think. That's the longest run. And then
Chokoloskee?
Chokoloskee, yeah.
Yeah, Chokoloskee. I went to college with that guy.
Yeah, we all just say Choco, but Chokoloskee is a small fishing village, sort of surrounded on, you know, four sides by the 10,000 Islands National Park. And then from Chokoloskee, you have to be past Flamingo, which is another 100 miles away, and that's in the middle of Everglades National Park. And you have until Friday morning to get to Flamingo and arrive and leave. And then you have basically 8 days to get to Key Largo from Tampa. So you have the following Sunday morning to finish. So there's a party Saturday or Sunday morning, like a barbecue and like an award ceremony Sunday morning for the race. So if you don't make the award ceremony, you didn't finish.
Okay. Now, do you pack all 8 days worth of food and water in the canoe with you?
Yes, I do. And that's kind of a requirement. I mean, unless you plan on stopping at restaurants along the way.
Well, you mentioned McDonald's earlier, so I wasn't
sure. Yeah. I mean, there's people that do it, but mostly those are sailboats that, you know, go much faster and are not so concerned about the time cutoffs. Us paddlers, you know, normally take 100% of what we need. And then depending on where you are on the race course, also 100% of your water. So that's, you know, for the backpacker listeners out there, it's one thing to walk 100 miles. It's another thing to carry 100% of your food and water that you need for 100 miles.
Got it. Now, let's not bury the lead. Did you finish this year?
I did.
Congratulations. I actually did really well. Yeah. That's awesome. Now, when you say you did really well, how well is really well?
So I think about 110 vessels started the race. I think there was, like I said, I think there was 12 in my class. And I was the only person in my class to finish. 2022.
That means first place.
That's right.
You are legend. Nice.
And but this year was an exceptionally hard year. Very high attrition rate. I think there was only 30 finishers overall out of 110. And I think there was 8 paddle craft that finished. And of the 8 paddle craft that finished, I was third to the beach. So there were 2 guys that finished ahead of me in class 1 or 2, which is the 2 sort of, you know, canoe kayak classes. One was a former Olympic athlete and the other sent a Guinness Book of World Records earlier that year for paddling the Mississippi, like a speed record for paddling the Mississippi.
Wow. Now, what put them in a different class than you? You said you were.
Yeah. So they're
all the 12, yeah. But you were third to these guys.
So they were in what are called class two boats, which are they didn't have sails. They're in a different class.
Got it.
I was the first person and only person to finish with a class one boat with a sail.
Understood. All right. So, I mean, it's got to feel pretty good. You finished right behind an Olympic athlete and a world record holder.
Yeah, I was, it was good. I was very happy.
All right. Now we skipped really quick there from the start to the finish, but I know there's a lot of things that happened in between those two moments.
Yeah.
You want to take us through some of the, maybe the high points, the low points, the misadventures, the, oh my gosh, am I going to make it kind of
situation. Yeah.
Type two fun.
Yeah. Type two. Yeah. And there was some type three for sure.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So day one was sort of uneventful, started at 7 a.m. Had a little bit of wind, sailed a little bit, but then very soon, you know, before probably noon on day one, the wind switched right into the nose. So, and it stayed there, paddling into the wind, which is why there was such a high attrition rate that year, because, you know, not everybody's prepared to paddle into the wind for 7 days. And certainly a lot of the sailboaters are not prepared to tack into the wind. So anyways, paddle along, make camp, didn't make checkpoint one the first night. A lot of the other people I was with pushed late, 2-3 in the morning, to make checkpoint one. I'm not a fan of doing that, cause I'm a big believer in rest is really important, especially in the beginning. So I tend to camp early, and then get up early and make checkpoint one, you know, right at first light the next day. And I did that, and when you're in the checkpoints, there's a sign-in log. So you can look back through the log and see, you know, when your friends or you know, competitors signed in and when they left. So I had a good idea. You know, there's a fairly good-sized group of people I knew in front of me. I didn't know how far in front of me they were because, you know, I stopped paddling, let's say, at midnight and was in bed asleep by 12:15. And they didn't get to the checkpoint till 3, you know, maybe didn't leave for an hour or so. And then the other problem is past checkpoint one, there's almost nowhere to camp. So they had to stop somewhere and sleep. So day two, weather was, as always, is a big factor when you're outside. I knew that day two late was going to be good for sailing. So I kind of took my time early day two, crossing was Charlotte Harbor, which is a big open body of water, which really messed me up in 2020. And I knew there was going to be a drop in the wind midday. So I intentionally like stopped at 11, took a, you know, long lunch in expectation of paddling late that night and crossing Charlotte Harbor in the lowest wind possible. Cause it was a straight headwind. Crossed Charlotte Harbor. Everything's going good. Had a couple issues with my boat, stop and fix those. But you know, obviously as a professional boat repairman, this is not a problem. And, Tuesday night's really where I had the first, good luck. So Tuesday night, the wind picked up out of the east. I'm headed south. So it's a, you know, perfect sailing conditions. And I really flew down the course Tuesday night. Still basically alone, not alone, but, you know, not seeing many people. I go from, a town called Matlachet, all the way down to the, Sanibel Bridge, which has a little island in the middle, camped on Sanibel Bridge that night, doing really well, made it, much, much farther than I had the year before was, you know, and sailed the whole time, almost didn't paddle at all from 8 p.m. till midnight. Made camp on Sanibel Island, which is a huge, or Sanibel Causeway Island, which is a huge mistake. Now I slept right next to a Port-a-John, but not in the Port-a-John. Close. But this island I slept on was infested with rats, like rats everywhere. to the point where they were like circling, like I was unpacking my stuff and trying to set up my tent, and they're like sniffing around my boat and like scurrying everywhere. So there was a piece of rebar sticking up out of the beach, like right on the water's edge. I took my boat into the water so the rats couldn't climb into my boat, eat my stuff, and tied my boat off in the water. And then tried to pull all my stuff into my tent so the rats wouldn't chew on my stuff. Unfortunately, I left one of my gloves out sitting, you know, hanging in a tree trying to dry off. And in the morning when I got up, there was just, it was just chewed to bits. The rats had gnawed on it, and there was, and it, the glove just did not smell right. So.
Yeah, I would imagine not. Now, was there ever any consideration to sleep on the boat? I mean,
I mean, maybe other boats you can sleep on, but, and I could have a very, unrestful, fitful night of sleep in my boat if I absolutely had to, but it's, you know, the thing's, you know, much narrower than my shoulders. So getting inside my boat and sleeping is not, I mean, it's physically possible, but, not a good idea, especially night two of a, you know, 6-7 day race.
Right. Now, I think earlier on the sock question, you said you were 300 pounds. Is that, were you exaggerating, or is that
accurate? No, I'm serious. I'm serious.
Serious. Okay. And how tall are you?
6'2".
6'2", 300 pounds.
Yeah. Okay. You know, Texas high school football player, played rugby in college.
Offensive lineman, defensive lineman?
Defensive lineman.
Wide receiver, maybe?
Yeah. Wide receiver's worst nightmare, maybe.
All right. So you escape almost unharmed from Rat Island. How does it go from there?
So get up the next morning. There's almost no wind. Paddle south of Sanibel. And then really soon meet up with a group of four other paddlers. I knew of these people, but I hadn't really met them so well. One of them is kind of an author that writes a lot about, paddle racing, and, his name is Rod Price. His, tribe name is called River Slayer. And then there's, three other people in like super high performance, real skinny kayaks. One is a married couple, a man and a woman, named, it was Mary and, Andy. And then another guy named Gil, who was friends with them. I had never really met them before. I knew of them just from hearing about them on the tribe, but, I think Gil was the least experienced of the group, who had only attempted 5 Everglades challenges and finished 4. And the rest of them had, finished, like Andy had finished 10. Everglades challenges and attempted 11. Rod, I think, had done 6 or 7, attempted 8. So I mean, these guys are, you know, tribe elders, elite Everglades challenge paddlers.
Right. How long has the Everglades challenge been in existence?
I think the first one was in 2000 or 2001.
Okay. So 20 plus years.
Right.
And like these people, I mean, do you plan on doing more Everglades challenges?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Maybe 24.
24
again. Yeah, in 2024.
Oh, not, in 2024, no. not 24. Yeah. 24 races.
No.
Okay. Does your wife know?
You know, I've mentioned it.
Is she going to find out listening to this podcast?
She may not. Yeah, she will definitely not listen to the podcast. 100%. No way. If she doesn't know,
I'll try not to take that personally.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think I'll definitely do it again. And there's a few other races, around that I'll probably do. There's like a race in North Florida that's like 250 miles, down a river that Rod Price actually hosts. Or there's a race called Chattajack. I think it's from Chattanooga, Tennessee to Jacksonville, Florida, river. Anyways, there's other races. I'm thinking about doing the MR 350 as well. The Missouri River. It's a 350 mile Missouri River race. But yeah. So Dave.
Now are river races, are they easier because you're going with the flow of the river? Or are you
paddling? Yeah. Well, it's a different thing. I mean, a river race, there's, you know, very little navigation. Obviously you have current with you. You know, where it's more of just a straight physical challenge. Like, you know, can you pull on the paddle long enough to make it fast enough to finish the race? Whereas Everglades Challenge is much more about navigation and choices on the race course, and tides are a big factor. So not only is it, you know, do you, you know, make the correct turn, but timing the turn or timing your arrival in a place so that the tides are advantageous. It's a significantly more complicated race course.
Now, were there ever any dicey moments in terms of navigation or decision making on this particular attempt of the challenge?
Absolutely. So kind of fast forward a bit, met up with the four other paddlers, which we dubbed ourselves the Five Amigos. We basically paddled together for the whole next day, you know, beautiful conditions down the beach, no problems. Make it to 10,000 Isles National Park, which is named that for a reason. There's maybe not literally 10,000 Isles, but close. Mary and Andy, the married couple who we're paddling with, have intimate knowledge of this place. Like they weren't debating on which way to go. They were debating on which migratory birds were most likely to be encountered on which island at what time, so we could view them. You know, it was like we were getting a tour of their, you know, finely manicured backyard. So the weather got nasty. So it's picked up. The wind picked up big time. We're getting 3 to 4 foot rollers offshore. And there is a route on the, you know, inside the islands to Chokoloskee where we needed to go. But finding that route is very difficult. So they're taking us through these tiny little cuts and tiny little islands that, according to my GPS, we're supposed to be on dry dirt, and, you know, paddle, you know, no wrong turns, like exactly like, okay, we're going to go up here 50 feet. You're going to see a big tree. It'll be on your left. And then we're going to make a right. And unbelievably, we made it through like perfectly. There's no way I would have made it through 10,000 Isles without, this amazing group of people. The weather was just awful. Trying to go on the outside, the straight, easy route, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico was treacherous, you know, big rolling waves.
Now, is this part of your strategy at the starting line?
That no,
you're going to find these four other people because you knew their expertise and just kind of tag along, or just kind of no, worked out that way?
It just worked out that way.
Nice. That's very fortunate.
Yeah. 100%. But yeah, it was good. Well, and you know, cause I focus on fitness, I was able to paddle fairly fast, and, I could have paddled faster than this group of people and, you know, left them. But I made a conscious decision of, you know, like really like Mr. You know, I attempted last year and failed, and now you're going to paddle away from, you know, arguably the four most experienced paddlers on the race course. Like, how about you just, you know, take the finish, follow the people that know what they're doing, and, you know, swallow your ego a little bit. So, I mean, it was definitely an intentional, like, you know, they were a little bit slower than me at times, but, you know.
That sounds like a pretty darn good decision, BS.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Nicely done.
So, we get to Chokoloskee, 3 a.m., camp, sleep, wake up the next morning. And, you know, I'm a math guy, right? So this is now day 4, which is Wednesday morning. We are 100 miles through the Everglades National Park. So there's no towns, there's no cities, there's no roads, there's no human anything of any kind for the next 100 miles. So we need to paddle 100 miles and get to the next checkpoint by Friday, the time cutoff is Friday morning at 8 a.m. for to arrive.
That's now, put a pin in right there, because I see direct parallels through hiking. And that is, you know, when I'm in the Sierras and I am in the middle of nowhere with no, you know, there's no bailout, there's no nearby town. If something goes wrong, it's going to go wrong and you have to deal with it. I imagine you have to have a pretty similar feeling being in the middle of the Everglades, being 100 miles away from anything.
The only difference is you got to carry all your water too.
Yeah.
Because it's all salt water. There's no fresh water. So, you know, not only like, for example, you know, like, you understand the like estimating how much food you're going to eat and estimating how much distance you're going to make. So if you end up going slow, not only are you going to run out of food, but I'm going to run out of water.
Right.
So, you know, it's a thing. You need to carry enough to get out, even if you have a bad day. So I'm laying in my tent that morning doing the math, thinking, you know, we got, you know, 48 hours or something like that to go 100 miles. And your boat is as heavy as it ever is because you're carrying, you know, 100 miles worth of water. So I left Chokoloskee with 28 liters in my boat. And then, you know, whatever food I needed for the rest of the race. I didn't think we'd make it. You know, I was like, look, if you guys want to go, I'll follow you into the Everglades. And, you know, we'll have a lovely paddle in the Everglades. And, you know, I'll call my wife from Flamingo. It'll be no problem. And the rest of the amigos gave me this unbelievable pep talk about, you know, like, you trained so hard and we've come so far and we're going to do this. And we did. So we left Chokoloskee at 10 a.m. on Wednesday. And then paddled continuously for 22 hours, making 70 miles in 22 hours. The reason of our extended paddle was we needed to make a tide. There's a section of the Everglades called the Nightmare, which is a cut through a tidal creek that at low tide is dry, you know, or not dry, but, you know, mucky dirt. And at high tide is a barely passable, you know, 3 foot wide creek through, you know, old growth Everglades. So we needed to make the high tide to make that section. At that time, there was, you know, a high tide every 12 hours. So if we didn't make that, it would put us back 12 hours. We wouldn't make our time cutoff. So we pushed hard through the night to arrive at the Nightmare at like 5 a.m. Then paddled through the Nightmare, which is the trees are so dense, you lose GPS signal. Like we have, everybody has a spot tracker as a part of the race requirement, and you lose your spot tracker, even doesn't get signal because the tree canopy is so dense. Make it through the Nightmare, and then paddle down what's called Harney Creek, and then make it to a Chicky, which is the only place to camp in the Everglades, which are essentially a dock with a roof on it. So because there is no dry land. So we make it to the Chicky about 9 in the morning, and then, you know, basically just fall out of our boats and sleep. Slept till 3 in the afternoon. I got up and ate, drank, but we still needed to make it another 30 miles. So that evening, we got back in our boats, paddled through the night to Flamingo, that we made it about 3 a.m. Now, there's a unique little spot of the Everglades called the Buttonwood Canal. So the Florida Everglades is the only place in the world where alligators and crocodiles exist together. But in the Buttonwood Canal, it's primarily crocodiles because it's a brackish, you know, salt and freshwater mixed canal. So we're exhausted, you know, obviously we've been paddling all night. And this section of the paddle, my, you know, focus on sleeping 5-10 minutes more than the people next to you and resting a little bit more really came in. They were all much more fatigued than me, and I was able to set pace and kind of keep them going. But by 3 a.m. I was exhausted, and resorted to, you know, belting out country ballads in order to stay awake through the Buttonwood Canal. Now, you Californians may not know this, but at night when you shine your light into brush and there's animal eyes that look back, predator eyes are red, and like frog eyes or non-predator eyes are like white or silver. And so going down the Buttonwood Canal, so sleepy, I'm about to fall on my boat. You turn your head left or right, and all you see is a sea of red eyes. All crocodile eyes.
And they're just waiting for BS to fall asleep and slide out of the boat.
Exactly. Exactly. So we make Flamingo. It's 3 a.m. The Flamingo is a nice place because it's really the only convenient like spot of luxury. There's a convenience store there, so you can buy breakfast and hot coffee and nice things like that. So, but the problem is you're not allowed to set up a tent there. So when we show up at 3 a.m., the mosquitoes are intense. You know, I'm putting my hood on, you know, cover my face. They're intense. So I basically use my tent as like a mosquito net, and then wedge a paddle like underneath my arm to sort of, you know, elevate the net off my back, and, you know, pass out with my earplugs in so the mosquitoes don't buzz me awake all night. Then the next morning, Andy wakes me up, and you know, it was more like reincarnating the dead. I did not want to get up. Apparently, he says he was shaking me for 5 minutes before I moved. But we wake up at 7, you know, had a breakfast burrito and a monster to go, and got in our boats and, you know, sailed across Florida Bay for the finish, which was awesome because that was actually March 11th, which is my 42nd birthday. And on the finish line, my wife and my two daughters were there waiting for me. And so I could hear them screaming at me from, you know, probably a mile out, because they can see me on their phones on the tracker, you know, like the race app tracker. And so as soon as I hit the beach, that, you know, the cheers went from like daddy, daddy to, you know, the whole crowd breaking out in a happy birthday. It was awesome.
How cool is that? What a way to finish.
Yeah, it was great.
And take us through, you know, what kind of emotions and thoughts are running through your mind as you finish this incredible, physically demanding event. I mean, you had trained for this, you've been unsuccessful in your previous attempt, and here you are now finishing it a year and a half later, 2 years later.
Right. Yeah. It was almost 5 years of effort for the finish. It was amazing. You know, I was happy. I was, but I think I was so fatigued. I wasn't able to like mentally shift gears out of like race mode. So I got to the beach and I'm, you know, walking, like my parents are there, and like, I'm walking around, like, you know, talking to everybody, and I just don't want to take off my life jacket. It's like a race requirement. Like, you must have your life jacket on at all times. You know, I hardly ever took it off. I really only took it off to sleep for the past, you know, 6 days or 7 days. And it got to the point where my mom had to like pull me aside. She's like, take your life jacket off. It's a little weird. You know, it's like, oh, well, this gives me safety, you know. And it took me a minute to, you know, mentally shift gears out of the race mode and into the, like, you know, rejoining society.
Right.
It was awesome.
Now, Brian, I know you've listened to the podcast. So you're familiar with the concept of post-trail depression. Is there such thing as a post-race depression? I mean, did you suffer?
I don't think so. It was, I was pretty beat up. Like, I basically slept the whole next, like, I got up, ate, slept more, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, I think I slept till like 10, got up, ate breakfast, slept till 2, got up, ate lunch, slept till 6, got up, ate dinner, you know, I slept a lot. I was so fatigued and beat up that, I don't really have any. It was, and plus the happy ending was, you know, so good. I don't think there was any depression. It was just pure joy.
Pure joy and a lot of eating and sleeping.
Yes.
Recovering. Got it.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, and BS, cold, you know where we are? Oh, you got something else?
I do know where we are. Oh, I was going to say, I cold beer. Plenty of that's the and best cold beer.
That's
recovery drink.
That is the best recovery drink. I agree. In fact, I'm gonna adjust your sanity scale up to like 68. Because you said that. So. Well, I always reserve the right to adjust that score a little bit as the interview goes on. So
there we are,
Brian. You know where we are?
I believe I do.
Yes. Where are we?
The pro tip. Inside of the week.
Pro tip insight of the week.
That's right, Half Calf. We are at the pro tip insight of the week, where BS is going to share some trail wisdom, some outdoor adventure wisdom with our listeners to make their next experience even better. So what do you have for us?
Okay, so on the mosquito theme, spray mosquito repellent is not that effective, especially down here in South Florida. So what the real Everglades explorers use is cream, like a lotion. Now there's two kinds of this lotion. One is like a DEET cream, which works really well, but is a little carcinogenic and will also melt plastic. If your DEET cream leaks like in your, you know, your waterproof bag, and it's some sort of polymer, it will turn it into like jelly. So there's another brand called Picadern that is not, doesn't have any DEET, less carcinogenic, and won't melt your pocket watch or your wristwatch if you accidentally get the cream on your watch.
I noticed you didn't say it's non-carcinogenic. You just said it's less carcinogenic.
As well, you know, because you're in California, everything causes cancer in California. So
that's right. DEET cream. You know, I think I've mentioned on this podcast a couple times, you know, when you have enough DEET on your face, it's when your lips go numb.
Yes.
And so I can't imagine a cream that dissolves plastic, actually rubbing that on your skin. But I mean, if the mosquitoes are bad enough, I guess you would try just about anything.
That's right.
So
yeah, don't go for the full DEET cream. You got to go the Picadern. It's a different chemical. Less cancery, I think. But it won't melt plastic. So like, okay, if you have like a G-Shock watch on, you put the DEET cream on there, like in an hour or so, your G-Shock watch will be a pile of goo.
Hmm. Now, you know, you being a math guy and not an English guy, I hesitate to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, just for clarification for our listeners out there. How do you spell Picadern?
Ha, bad question. I will Google it for you.
Drop that into Google.
Yeah. I'm going to do what all good dyslexic kids do when they can't spell.
Oh, if you're not watching this on YouTube, that was just a classic moment because he's sitting kind of in a dark room and he says, I'm going to Google it. As soon as he says that, he obviously has touched his computer and his whole face is now kind of washed out in this bright white glow.
Okay. It is spelled repellent.
We're going to get this for our listeners. We want them to know what he's talking about here.
Okay. So the product is made by Sawyer.
Okay.
And it is spelled Picadern.
Okay.
Picadern.
But it's made by Sawyer. I mean, so you can trust Sawyer. Sawyer's a good brand.
Yeah. Very, very low on the, you know, cancery scale.
Oh, you know what? That might be the title of the episode. Low on the cancery scale. You also said something earlier. It's a thing. That might be the title of the episode too. I'm always on the lookout for good title suggestions just from our commentary.
So, yeah.
All right. So there you have it. That's it. This episode is just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with BS. Want to thank him for joining us this week. BS, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
I'm on Facebook, Brian Sheridan, and then I'm on Instagram, Brian Sheridan 04.
04. Is that new as well?
I'm new to the Insta.
New to the Insta. Brian Sheridan 04.
Yep.
Okay. Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We're on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com.
The adventure media recommendation.
Now, Brian, I know we already talked about some adventure media earlier on with, what was my recommendation? Deep Water yes. on YouTube. But I want to hear something from you as well. Do you have a recommendation for some kind of documentary, movie, or book related to outdoor adventure you can share with our listeners?
Oof. So I'll just repeat my last one. And that's if you go to YouTube, there's a guy, I mentioned him earlier, Conquistador in the Water Tribe. His name is Scott Bass. And he has a great YouTube channel called Sup Sojourner, and he does amazing videos, gear videos, adventure videos. Learned a lot from, he lives in Key Largo, buddy of mine, but if you're looking to get into paddle racing, his gear suggestions are good and very detailed.
Okay, fantastic. Conquistador.
Yep.
Have we not asked you?
And before we wrap things up, I've got just one more segment for you called What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About? What did we miss tonight?
Okay, so the two characters in my story, Mary and Andy, they live in Tampa, but Mary's parents were sort of in ground zero for Hurricane Ian. 24 hours after the storm had passed, her mom called her saying that she was trapped in her attic with 6 feet of water in the house. Mary reached out on Facebook, was looking for people to maybe help rescue her mom or, do anything they could. I had messaged her back a few times, but eventually was like, look, I think you need to go, rescue her yourself. So, Thursday night late, her and Andy packed up an 22 foot four person canoe, drove down to her mom's house, paddled into her neighborhood, which was still had 4 to 5 feet of water in it. Collected her mom and her dad, their dog and a bird, and self-rescued her mom out of her, house in, I believe the neighborhood's called North Point, which is near Fort Myers.
Wow. That's incredible. Heroes.
Yeah. Well, and
rescuing their parents and their pets.
Right. So, and these two people have done, multiple, like 10 or 11 Everglades challenges between them. So that was little did you know, your years of Everglades challenge experience were just training to rescue your mom.
Wow.
And dad.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It was happy end of the story. And they were fine. Everything's good.
Good.
Yep.
Good. I know a lot of folks, millions of folks down in Florida have experienced just unbelievable loss and struggle. From your perspective, you're in Florida, what is it like down there right now?
Well, I'm in sort of, the much farther south and on the East Coast. So, for us, the storm was a non-event, it was a little bit windy, a little bit rainy.
Right.
There's a big section of, Southwest Florida, sort of, Sanibel, Fort Myers, North Point, Charlotte Harbor area that is washed away. For example, the Rat Island that we talked about, that island is now cut in half by the hurricane, cutting the island in half and the road that passed over it. The Sanibel Causeway is cut in half in two places. It's bad. There's going to be, years and years to rebuild. And, my heart goes out to all the people affected by the storm. It's
absolutely
a terrible thing.
Yep. Yep. No doubt. Now, that's a wrap from the John Freakamere studio. Any shout outs to friends and family, BS?
You know, just my amazing wife and kids and my parents who support me in my crazy adventures.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. Doesn't care if you want to go downhill. Doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if all you see is red predator eyes all around you. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.